revenue on our scheduled day work session. The schedule for Senate Bill 559 and public hearing possible work sessions for bills. Senate Bill 537, House Bill 2133, and Senate Bill 1211. So we will begin with a work session on Senate Bill 559. Mr. Chandler is here. Mr. Chandler has caused the -1 amendments to be drafted and discovered.
Yes, indeed.
We welcome you. If you identify yourself for our record and proceed, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association. Here on behalf of Senate Bill 559, the -1 amendments thereto. A slight clarification of the Chairman's opening remarks. I caused them to be drafted only in the most rudimentary sense of asking Dexter to please decipher what DOR had mentioned during our last hearing and write it now. I am given to understand that that's what the -1 amendments are. I personally hate to take a quiz on them, but on a quick review, it certainly accomplishes the purposes we had in mind for this bill, which was to allow an income tax deduction for SBC payments without causing violence to the rest of Oregon's tax scheme by inadvertently using the wrong words to refer to things in the statute. Now, the main change, I believe, in the -1, Mr. Chairman, is the definition of principal residence as opposed to personal residence. There were some other clarifications that the Department of Revenue had suggested. I believe Mr. Johnson also incorporated those into the -1 amendments.
All right. Now, Mr. Chandler.
Mr. Chairman.
At our first hearing, my recollection, we didn't have adverse testimony.
The OEA actually showed up, Mr. Chairman.
Were they concerned? Or?
They thought this would come out of the school fund.
Okay, well, I want to share with you a fax I've received today and just get your reaction to it. It says Senate Bill 559 is attempting to create a personal income tax subtraction for amounts actually paid or incurred by a taxpayer that are attributable to system development charges. Will that be correct?
Yes.
Senate Bill 559 states, quote, whether or not the taxpayer directly paid the cost of the system development charge, end of quote. The writer says, this is ridiculous. I won't hold the misspelling of ridiculous against the author. This is simply another device for the Oregon Building Industry Association to use to circumvent paying for development. If we allow a personal income tax subtraction for system development charges, what is next? A personal income tax subtraction for building permits? I'd just like to get your response to this person's objection to this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just... The initial response probably shouldn't go on the record. The subsequent response would be that this bill allows on $10,000 FCC would allow a $900 tax benefit, basically a 9% rate. This is not an attempt in any way, shape, or form to avoid paying for development. What has happened in a typical case, and the reason the bill is phrased in that fashion, whether or not the taxpayer directly paid the cost, is that typically the builder pays the SBC at the time of building permit. Sometimes it's at the time of subdivision, depending on the jurisdiction. That fee is then lumped into the sales price of the home. It is very rarely, in fact, I'm not sure of any circumstances where the builder calls it out separately. Our friends in local government would prefer that we didn't do that, frankly, because that would show on the closing statement of the cost of local government, and that would be cause people to raise their eyebrows and correct to their mayor. So typically, that cost is paid by the developer, passed on to the buyer in the price of the home, and the bill is phrased to address that. So the taxpayer is paying it indirectly. The taxpayer is paying for the home. The purchase price of the home includes the FCC, which is paid to the local government. I think that to address that point. As to the deductibility of building permits, that's probably outside the relating clause. It's a darn fine idea.
I was just going to ask. Well, they gave you an idea.
Yeah, sure. But if the rules committee is here, I might want to speak with them after.
Are there other questions? We thank you for your testimony. We do have Mr. Hingen. And Mr. Chandler, you might want to hang in there, I think. Unless Mr. Ingen is here to sing its praises, you might need to respond to.
I'm not here to sing its praises, sir.
I expected that. Thank you. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself.
Yes, my name's David Ingen, and I live here in Salem. I'm just an ordinary taxpaying citizen of Oregon. And I appreciate Mr. Chair and the members of the committee the opportunity to speak to you about this. I just learned about it today. And there may be some things in here which I don't understand fully, and listening to Mr. Chandler helped to clear up a little bit of it. But I view this as basically a shift of some of the cost of the city's infrastructure to the income tax paying public. And then that brings up a couple of questions. Why should a rancher or a farmer help to pay for Portland's or Salem's infrastructure? Because they're paying income tax also. Why not extend the exclusion to the rest of us who are paying for bonds which support the extension of the city services and schools and whose sewer and water bills are raised every year to help pay for new sewer and water lines? And that's happening here in Salem every year. There are other ways to help to pay for the city's infrastructure, and I would like to read you a portion out of a Silverman paper. Woodburn paper, which came out on the 21st of April, 1999. And it quoted Richard Carson, the guy who wrote the Paying for Our Growth in Oregon. He suggested three ways of paying for growth without increasing housing costs. One, continue the use of traditional voter-approved general obligation bonds and serial levies. Well, I'm paying those now, and I think that probably those are some of the things which cause people to vote for Measure 5 and 47. And et cetera, because the rest of us are being impacted by a growth rate. Introduce an annexation charge that would decrease the profit to the annexing property owner, and three, program the cost into existing utility rates. Well, that's already happening in Salem. And I would be very happy to hear what Mr. Chandler had to say about that or answer any questions you have for me. Thank you.
Would you generally feel the same way about home mortgage deductions in general tax law?
Well, a home mortgage deduction, you can take deductions on.
Correct.
Yes.
I mean, but it also then impacts the revenue stream and the taxpayers who perhaps don't claim such a deduction. So would you be in favor of eliminating that?
Well, I look at this as basically, when I say the rancher or farmer, he's taking a home mortgage deduction too.
Right.
Right. But when he pays his income tax, as long as the guy who is taking a deduction for STCs gets that deduction for STCs, that means somebody's going to have to pick up that part of the deduction to pay for that infrastructure. And it could be anybody who's paying the income tax, who's paying for part of it.
We thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, sir.
Appreciate your being here today. Mr. Chandler, do you have a response you'd like to share?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, John Chandler, for the record. Just a couple quick thoughts. One, with regard to Mr. Emmy's point about the tax shift, there is a certain element of that, to be sure. Anytime there's a tax attraction allowed, as I said in that earlier testimony on this bill, what we're trying to do here is essentially take system development, infrastructure paid for with system development charges in the same category as infrastructure paid for with the profit tax revenue. That is a deductible item against, either a subtractable item, I get those two confused, against the income tax. We're not trying to raid the Treasury here. We're simply make essentially a fairness argument. With regard to his comments on Mr. Carson's work, I would recommend that to the committee. It's a very good piece. Rich Carson was the former planning director at Oregon City. Before that, he's at Metro. He's currently the planning director for Clark County, Washington. He did a very good study on paying for the cost of growth in Oregon. We get copies if you don't have it. I think he distributed it.
Of course, yes.
One of the most intriguing, frankly, and it drops well, probably relating to this bill, but it's something the revenue committee might find interesting. This is most of an annexation fee. And I puzzle on that, trying to figure out how you would do one that wouldn't violate Measure 5 or be outside of the, would become an income of growth-based transfer tax. But Mr. Carson's notion was very simple, that you have land outside the boundary, which has a very low basis and a very low valuation. When the boundary moves, there is automatically an increase in value. Theoretically, that increase in value would be taken out by the marketplace and told because infrastructure has to be provided for the value to be realized. We went through the purchase price would adjust to reflect that. In the real world, that doesn't necessarily happen. And there is an event occurring there that may be worth looking at. I don't have an opinion. We don't have a company policy. I thought when Mr. Carson floated the notion that it was intriguing. It was outside the box, as the cliche goes. And there you have it. Also outside the relating clause of this bill. I'm glad Mr. Engine called it to your attention.
All right. Another question. Senator Wild, thank you, sir. Now, in Texas, have we dealt with the Dash 1?
We have not adopted the Dash 1.
We're
going to work on that, and then we're discussing.
Okay.
Section 2 of 1. How are we getting the information to the taxpayer in the situation where, in that section, in construction of taxpayer's principal residence, whether or not the taxpayer directly paid the cost of the system development charge? What kind of form or how is the taxpayer being informed that, in fact, SDC was paid?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Wild, we discussed that with DOR. They indicated, and Ms. Browning's here, I believe I'll state that this isn't correct, but they weren't interested in having a form here of any of reporting. It'd be more of a matter, as far as DOR is concerned, that if you claimed it and you got audited, you better, by golly, have something to prove it, which led to the next point of how would we address this within the real estate transaction itself. And what I suspect would happen would be a statement from the builder or whoever paid the builder developer whoever paid the fee in the first place, probably a copy of the local government docket, because all these are a matter of public record, indicating the amount of the fee and when paid, and that would be given to the buyer, and I presume that would be adequate proof for DOR.
I just want to make sure it's not something, where the buyer calls up the builder and says, oh, by the way, how much was it? And they say, well, I think it was about $1,537, so that sounds close. And I mean, I'd like it to be a little more official than that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wild, I certainly can't guarantee that wouldn't occur in some cases, but none of our members would ever engage in such sloppy bookkeeping.
I didn't hear that.
By golly.
Hey, thank you for your headroom. Is there no further questions? Before us are the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 559. Recognize Senator Wild.
I will move the Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Wild moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 559. Is there a discussion? Senator Beyer.
Go right ahead.
Oh, not on the amendment? All right. Is there a discussion, further discussion of the amendments? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is agreed to. Senator Beyer.
This question in the bill with the Dash 1 is the revenue impact bill after the
expansion. Mr. Waters?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byers, the Dash 1 amendment is just, I think, clarifying, cleaning it up, the revenue impact.
So it's still 3.5 and forthcoming by any means?
To the best of my knowledge.
Okay.
All right. Senator Wild moves the Senate Bill 559 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Helps my laryngitis stop having to say what I said.
Is there a discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator
Hartman.
Aye. Senator Byers.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wild. Aye.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. Senate Bill 559 is passed to the floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 559. Senator Wild, thank you. All right, we'll now open up a public hearing in a possible work session with a public hearing on Senate Bill 537. Mr. Carlson is here. This would make a modest change that Mr. Carlson will describe. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, Gary Carlson with Associated Oregon Industries. Speaking in support today of Senate Bill 537. We ask the introduction of this and other income tax reduction bills this session because we believe the owner's income tax should be reduced. Since 1959, the total tax burden on average American workers has increased from 24% to 36%. There does not appear to be any sign of abatement despite the surplus at the national level and the rapid rate of growth of the state's general fund over the past several biennia, I might say many biennia. Senate Bill 537 would increase the limitation on the deductibility of federal taxes on the Oregon return from its current $3,000 level to $10,000. And you'll recall that there is an initiative circulating at this point in time to completely eliminate any limit on deductibility of federal taxes on the Oregon return. In January, your staff provided you with a history of this provision of the Oregon Code and its attached. History showed that the concept of limiting deductibility of federal taxes on the Oregon return was defeated three times by Oregon voters before it was implemented as a so-called temporary measure in 1974. The limit was then increased to $5,000 in 1975 and $7,000 in 1979 and decreased to $3,000 in 1987. That was part of the state conformity with a massive federal tax code change in 1986. Although some aspects of Oregon's tax system have been indexed for inflation, the federal tax deduction limit remains unindexed. This means that the state gets a windfall every year as more and more Oregon income taxpayers are pushed beyond the $3,000 limitation, and they begin to pay Oregon income taxes as a portion of their federal income tax. And just one interesting historical side note is there's a lot of talk often about the low level of income, taxable income, at which our income tax rate brackets push people to the top bracket of 9%. Well, if you go back and look at the data, because those brackets were unindexed, in 1969, a substantial proportion of income taxpayers never hit the top bracket. Today, almost all, the vast majority of taxpayers certainly hit the top bracket. The lack of indexation. The result is a rapidly escalating growth of state revenue in the general fund. This issue is really simple and straightforward. Limiting the deductibility of federal tax amounts to a tax levied upon a tax. And voters rejected this concept several times in the past. The 3,000 limit is unindexed, which means, as I mentioned, that every taxpayer, or every year more and more Oregonians get pushed into being affected by the limitation. We urge your support in increasing and indexing for the future the federal tax deduction limit. We have not suggested elimination of the limit. The revenue impact is substantial, as you can see, even from the $10,000 limitation. But I think as you look at alternatives for addressing components of the Oregon personal income tax system, this is one that you have to take a close look at. Did they have any answer to any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Are there questions? Could you tell me if we had just left the $7,000 figure alone in 1979 and then indexed, you know what would that be in today's dollars, as they say?
Ed could probably come closer, but I'm going to guess 20 years of inflation, it would be well beyond $10,000.
A lot more.
It'd be more than double.
You had the answer, John?
No.
All right. Are there questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Speer. Gary, what was magical about 10,000?
Nothing, really, Senator Beyer. It just seemed that we ought to start somewhere for our debate, and that seemed like as good a place to start as any.
Any negotiations, it's better to start high.
Yeah, absolutely.
What would be your reaction, given the revenue impact? I mean, $319 million is a pretty big hit. You come to square, if you're just looking at indexing that, starting over out, better than nothing?
Oh, just, I'm sorry, Certainly, I think that, you know, it'd be something I'd like to see you try to increase it somewhat in addition to indexing, because it has been a long time at that level.
Has there been any look at what the impact is by income taxpayer bracket, sort of who's affected directly?
Your staff, I think, could tell you my recollection from data that they've produced before is that it has, first of all, it has impact only on itemizers. Secondly, it tends to have the most favorable impact on the broader middle income. Just to pick a range, I'd pick a range from $40,000 to $80,000 on a joint return. They are going to get significant effect out of this. If you go above $100,000 very far, you're going to soon bump into the $10,000 limitation that is proposed in this bill. So the lower income would likely not have, unless they're itemizing, would have little that are not hitting the $3,000 not hitting the other end of this thing, the $3,000 because of their income. Would not be affected. Non-itemizers would not be affected.
Actually, if I might, this is an income tax subtraction, so it's not dependent on whether or not the taxer itemizes. But I think the rest of what you said is fairly
okay.
Mainly, the impact is on people, current filers between 40 and 70,000.
Represent buyer. I think the taxpayers
above. You're on a TV station.
I'm sorry. I think taxpayers above about 30 something thousand adjusted gross income are already paying more than the $3,000 federal income tax. So that's where the benefit would begin to be felt in that range. And would peak out at around, I think, between $80,000 and $100,000 of when people are paying close to $10,000 in federal income tax.
Other questions? Mr. Waters, if you could help me with the revenue impact statement here a little bit. The $319 million impact, figure 9901, the asterisk indicates that bill would not be in effect during the 99 tax year. So the 319 represents 1 year
of
biennium? Or
similar, it's one plus because of the effect on estimated taxes and withholding that you would expect during the 2000 and into the 2001 tax year, or the 2001 tax year.
Okay. That was, I'm going to ask you how you got to 495 and not being twice the impact.
There's a startup phasing effect starts when you start something like that in the first year.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 537? Mr. Schellenberg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. In case it makes any difference, I just wanted to support the bill as well, offer Farm Bureau support to this bill. We have the chairman of our tax advisory committee is passionate about this issue, and he sees it as being a definite inequity and would like to have the change. And as far as technical testimony, I would simply say whatever Mr. Carlson said. I don't know any more about it than that. I don't even know that about it. But it sounded good, whatever he said. But the concept is the correct concept, and it's the concept that we would support and would ask your passage of Senate Bill 537.
Following up on Senator Byer's question regarding numbers, anything would be an improvement? Did your discussion get as precise as identifying $10,000 versus 5 versus nothing?
Mr. Chairman, I believe, in fact, that our chairman of our advisory committee suggested the same figure, not knowing that Mr. Charlson had that figure in his bill. He had thought about this concept a long time ago, and as if memory serves me correct, I think the 10,000 was the figure he came up with. Is it a technical figure that has some significance? No, that's correct, it's not. Yes, anything is better than nothing, but it should be, you know, at least significant, not just 3,001.
Without putting words in your mouth or the chairman's mouth, this impact that we have before us of the revenue loss to the state of $319 million for the 9901 biennium, I'm sure you're aware of the criticism that some will give to this proposal. How would you respond to it?
That's a good question. What's a good answer?
I suspect it'll be asked. Mr. Carlson, I think, suggested it's a question of fairness.
It is that. It's tax on taxes, which does not seem to be fair. And in that regard, something is better than nothing, and I believe you talked about indexing as well. Some movement that would be, you know, have some significance, plus the indexing of that figure would be appropriate, so there might not be a very large impact to start with, but it'd work its way in. We think that would be a fair way to begin.
Are there other questions? Senator Wild, I just would like to ask Mr. Schellenberg if, in fact, you think maybe we should apply an $80,000 test to this bill.
No.
Anyway. Thank you. Senator Beyer.
So, Don, your chair of your committee must obviously be one of those rare farmers who's making a profit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, that's correct. There's two or three that I can think of, and he's one of them. Yeah.
They're not the ones we normally hear from.
That's correct.
Two or three are currently due. All right. Are there other questions?
Thank
you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 537? If not, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 537. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 537. Senator Wild?
I was just wondering, because you've talked about 5,000, I was just wondering if that's what you want to pursue or if you want to stick with 10,000. I'm just curious.
Well, that's why we're having a discussion.
I'm waiting for a reply.
Clearly, I think my view of fairness would be that it should not be limited.
You would like to eliminate all?
Okay.
Well, that would be my view of fairness. I recognize there is a revenue impact that will cause others to not subscribe to that position. So, but I also agree with what Mr. Carlson said, that almost any number, including indexing, is an improvement in the current situation. So if we can arrive at some number that this committee would agree with, then I'm more satisfied than I am with the current approach.
Well, I agree with you on this. The 5% figure, or $5,000 figure would live with twice.
I'd be glad to have discussion, and then we can cause amendments to be drafted if there's an interest in it by this committee. Senator Beyer.
I guess I could support the indexing. I'm not sure. I'd have to have more of a discussion on the logic of how we got to 3 versus 5 versus some other number. Given the budget where we're at now, I think it would be hard for us to take a step up very far, particularly if we're talking in terms of $100 million, $1,000 exemption, something like that.
Presumably the 5 would reduce the impact down to about 160.
Yeah.
Mr. Waters would tell me that's true. We just cut that in half if we went from 10,000 to 5,000. Does it work that way?
No, it doesn't. here.
Good try, though.
Try this new math from the Portland Public Schools you got from me. All right. Do you have an estimate of what that might be?
Not handy.
More or less? Would it be more than 160? If we could see maybe the 5,000, would the impact, is your notion that it would be much less than half of the projected 319 if we cut the 5,000, or would it be?
I would think it would be less because it's less than half of the way to $10,000.
Still probably over 100 million,
I would imagine.
And I would also say, and I haven't researched the legislative history of this, but as Mr. Carlson indicated, this number has bounced around a bit from 3,000 to 5,000 or 7,000 back to 5,000 and was rejected in concept 3 times by the voters of Oregon when they could face it. So, probably just came about in a revenue committee like this.
It's only been in place for a decade and a half.
Always time to change it. But there are probably more people now, as Mr. Carlson indicated, who are so fortunate as to pay a heavy amount of tax to the federal government who are a bit offended that they have to pay.
Well aware of that after writing to the tax out to the federal government.
Yeah. Senator Starr, I think that in the interest of fairness, that we've got to do something. And I think that 5,000 is just a step up. But I don't believe that it will deter the initiative petition that's being circulated, which is eliminated. And so, I think that we could be very prudent going forward with the 5,000 indexing that. Well, let me see if the committee would agree to this, that we will have an amendment drafted to reflect the number 5,000, and maybe the water should run the revenue impact on that figure, as well as we will index that figure. Bring that back to this meeting as soon as those amendments are developed. Is it suitable for the majority of the members? If it is, then I appreciate that. Is there any other item that ought to be addressed in the amendments? Okay, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 537. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill. We'll move to Senate Bill 1211. Now let me back up. Hey, hold on that. Unless the Mr. Douglas, did you want to speak to 1211 or 2133? Is there a preference here, or are you comments? All right, we'll stay in the public hearing on Senate Bill 1211. And Mr. Douglas, glad to have you back.
My name is Don Douglas. I'm a partner at law firm Miller Nash in Portland, Oregon, and I'm co-chair of the Tax and Public Policy Committee of the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative. Senate Bill 1211 is the capital gains rollover, as we call it. I believe I've spoken to every member of the committee. And rather than wear my welcome pin, if you have any questions on the legislation, there is no known opposition. The evidence in support of the economic impact of this is only growing. Since I last testified to you, Arizona has come out with a study indicating that every dollar invested in this type of investment has a multiplier effect of 7, meaning that it generates $7 of revenue from that investment. And the last time I was here, I said it would probably be between 3 and 5. So I think the evidence is becoming even more compelling. But if anyone would like a description of the bill again, I'd be happy to walk you through it. As I say, there's no known opposition. It is one of those bills where I think it really satisfies 4 goals in this area. It's kind of one that really hits them all. And the revenue impact is one that it's an investment in Oregon's future that I think we need to make.
I would appreciate one more brief review of the bill.
The bill has four purposes. It tries to stop the flight of people who move to Vancouver when they are asked to sell their business to avoid the state capital gains tax. And we have compiled some data on it, but it is difficult to get specifics. We all have anecdotal individuals, but it's hard to get them to testify before you because the fear is it will trigger an audit. And but I can tell you that lawyers and accountants advise their clients when they're about to sell that this is an option that they have, and not an insignificant number do move. And you have in the Department of Revenue a study that tried to document the lost revenue, and I'd be willing to tell you that I believe that it's far less than documented there. The impact is far greater than is documented there. The second purpose of this is to create incentives for people to invest in Oregon emerging growth capital, emerging growth companies. Third is the people who will invest in this bill are the people who we call the angel investors, the ones who are willing to take the greatest risk when a company is just starting, when it doesn't have a product, when it has a concept, and where you don't have capital markets now investing. The venture capitalists will wait until the product is actually out, and you just can't get funding at this point, and companies die if they can't get the funding. So this bill will create, by creating a tax incentive for people who have sold their business, these individuals will have an incentive to invest in Oregon business, providing that angel capital. And then the fourth is that once people invest, these are the people who will often have the kind of expertise that they need to help and mentor other startup companies, or if these people feel like doing it again, they will be the startup people again, just a little wiser from their experience. If you speak with venture capitalists, they will tell you that they will invest not only on the technology, but predominantly on the management, the people that they're investing in, and they will tell you that Oregon has a dearth of recognized management. We've got a good crop that is working its way through as these companies sell or exit. This crop will be available to seed other companies. And this bill, what it essentially does is when you sell your business, if you invest in an Oregon business within 2 years, then the capital gains that you would otherwise pay at the state is deferred, and if you invest for a period of 5 years, it is eventually exempted at 20% a year. So the longer you're in Oregon on the impact, the more revenue that's generated, the less the ultimate tax. And it's a reward for having made that investment in an emerging startup, having been an angel investor, and then having hopefully provided the management to carry that company through. And the period of time that's moved from the current statute, which is 6 months, 2 years, people who have created a business really aren't in a position to invest within 6 months. So the statute as it currently exists, has been very poorly used, very infrequently used, and those who have tried to use it have been very vocal in terms of their advice that the ambiguities currently in the statute are so enormous that one should never use the statute. So all we've really done is gone into the statute, taken a good idea, cleaned up the ambiguities, made it far more functional, and tried to strengthen each of those four goals.
Thank you. Are there questions? There one? Do you have a question? No? The revenue impact, now, talk about the positives. A revenue impact statement, maybe Mr. Waters, you can help me out here, says that in the first biennium, this would have a revenue impact of $14 million, the negative. And the subsequent biennium of 28.
I have not seen that report. It requires assumptions as to the frequency in which it would be used, that depends on how frequently you believe people will be able to sell their businesses and then decide to use this.
This assumes a $3 billion average annual Oregon capital gain, 5% participation rate and 9% marginal tax rate. And Mr. Waters, you go ahead and explain this.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's admittedly pretty rough, but as a starting point, I assume that of the approximately $3 billion in taxable net capital gain that has been realized on average in the last
three tax years, that's say 5% of it I'd qualify under the deferral and exclusion. And a 9% marginal tax rate, that saves about a $14 million revenue cost per year.
The current statute, the last revenue estimate for the current statute, I believe, was $45 million as to the impact. But I think the actual impact was about $6 million. And in the last biennium, I think it's $6 million in the 1995 and 97, and I believe around $2 or $3 million in the 97 and 99. And the question I think you need to ask yourself as well is that how much of this money would escape taxation anyway as people become more sophisticated in terms of moving to Vancouver? But you might be losing, if you're bothered by the amount, I personally am not, but I think it's money that could not be better spent, I would say. But if you're bothered by the number, you need to also realize that that number can be completely eliminated to the extent people are advised of the ability to move to Vancouver and avoid the tax.
Help me with this, Mr. Waters and Mr. Douglas. I'm sure it is admittedly very difficult to know the impact of what this reinvestment might bring about in the jobs and the economic stimulation that would also bring some revenues that are not now available into us. Is that figured somehow in this, or is that just you're just looking at people who are fleeing? How do you do this?
This number is taken from the tax return data for the three tax years, 1995, 96, 1997. And just taking a portion of the net capital gain that was realized in those three tax years, that was realized as Oregon taxable income and taxed by Oregon. So it excludes anything that is already left the state and was not taxed by the state. It doesn't assume that really the trend for increase in capital gains continues. It's a straight raw arithmetic average of capital gains for those 3 years, which nearly doubled between 1995 and 1997.
Senator, maybe some statistics. I mean, again, some of this is anecdotal, but the strongest evidence I think you have of what seed investment can do is the Oregon Research Technology and Development Fund, which was a state organization designed to provide funding to seed. And it's a different mechanism than we're currently using. It doesn't bring any of the management, doesn't bring any of the mentoring, and doesn't fill in it fills in some of the angel investing needs. But in their last annual report, the total amount paid to RTDF was $12.3 million over 12 years. Their last annual report indicates that they've invested in 50 companies in their investment in Oregon. They've helped create 1,600 jobs, and the average salary is $40,000, which means $64 million in wages each year. So it would be, I've testified on the return, I can't do the math quite immediately, but let's say that you get about $5.5 million in taxes on that, so you're getting about a 60% return on your investment each year. That doesn't deal with companies that then will spin off from this. The companies that are seeded with venture capital, and here we've gone to the stage where venture capital is invested, where we have stronger statistics. 45% of their equity is spent in research and development. Research and development is the breakthrough technology that leads to other companies, so you have the spin-off. So you find that the impact just in the ORTDF is a tremendous return in the jobs that it creates. Kind of jobs and where the money is spent is the kind that will have the biggest impact on Oregon's economy and its ability to compete, really, in the 21st century. I always fear stating this because it may sound like the issue for Oregon is really one of how we'll live in the 21st century. We can either be proactive and recognize what the information technology or the new economy or whatever you want to call it will be, or we could be a backwater where we are doing natural resources that without the technology or providing kind of a third world country. The choice and the dynamic are really Oregon's to make, and the competition is out there in terms of what other states are doing. And we are losing business because of other incentives. And we're losing it just to our sister state immediately, because once people move there, they become integrated into the economy and the neighborhood. And we have lost talent, and we can't afford to do that. But in terms of the economic impact, another statistic that I've shared previously, I believe, with this committee is in the first half of 1998, the amount of venture capital in Washington was $160 million. The amount of venture capital in Oregon was $14 million. Washington is getting 11 and a half times more venture capital money than we are. And we have to stop that hemorrhage. We have to not lose what talent we do have. And we have to really seed this area to make it grow.
Let me ask you about one statement you made during your presentation of no known opposition. It has occurred to me through the first almost 4 months of this legislative session that anything that provides a break to the taxpayer or reduces revenues to the general fund be opposed by the current chief executive. Have you checked the pulse of the chief executive on this?
Yes. I believe, I have not personally, but people who have worked with me have assured me that this is receiving a good reception with the governor. I do not believe it will be opposed.
That'll be a wonderful departure.
Senator Beyer.
Sure. I really like this bill. I think this is the kind of targeted kind of incentive that makes a whole lot of economic sense, and I think, you know, the nature of the way that we do the revenue requests is, as we discussed with the single factor sales tax last week before, there's some unknown, but the thing that's positive about this approach is you know you're going to get a return because they only get the deferral if they make the investment. So you're going to get something. You don't know whether it's 60% or 10%, but you know you're going to get something. So you know that $14 million is going to be less than that. It may not know exactly what. And I think we all acknowledge, those of us who have been talking tax policy around here, that we do have some loss of income that's going across the river. I think it's probably less than we speculate sometimes. So it is there, and it makes sense. This incents people to make the right kind of investment, invest in Oregon's future, and I think it has a spread not only to their own pocketbook and bank account, but to other people who need good job opportunities. And I would say that the other side of it is the investments tend to be in technology and in industries which were more likely to provide high wage. So it's getting the kinds of jobs that we've talked about around here a long time in economic policy that makes good sense.
Senator Wild.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to go back to the calculation of the revenue impact because I realize it's more guesstimate than anything else, but it just strikes me that 5% of all capital gains in this state being attributable to this type of activity, it's just my gut feeling is that seems quite high, especially for the years taken into consideration here, because at that time, the capital gains in the sale of your personal residence was still, I mean, you didn't have the current exclusion, and so let's face it, there's been a lot of real estate transactions in this state in that 3-year period. The sale of stocks and bonds, I mean, which clearly has generated the increase in our the capital gains we've taken in, that wouldn't apply to this, and it's still just, to me, 5% seems rather high, and obviously when you're dealing that small a percentage, changing from 5 to 4 can have a significant impact on the revenue impact. So I'm just wanting to make sure that 5% is based on something.
Senator Wild, I admit it, it's a fairly rough guess. The thing that keyed, I guess, the number, you know, that percentage that high is the change in the bill that would allow stock acquired through exercise of non-qualified stock options or incentive stock options issued to an officer, director, or employee of an issuing entity to also be eligible to defer the gain on that or exclude it after 5 years. Now, we've heard all about how the stock options for highly paid employees of some of the high tech firms recently been expanding in the area, exploded in the recent years. That's what triggers that number. There's not really a lot of data underlying that other than feeling that, well, it's, you know, not too big, but maybe it's not too small either.
And that is, Chair, I would like to ask about the stock acquired through the exercise and all costs, the stock option, the stock option issued to a master, et cetera, et cetera. You feel that's an incredibly important part of the bill, or was that something that was added because it seemed like a reasonable thing to do?
Well, let me share with you the analysis, and perhaps that will kind of say a spectrum that goes on, because it's kind of hard to decide. What happens under the current statute is if you are issued founder stock, if you are one of the original founders and issued stock, you get the benefit of this provision. The way you, as a startup company, you cannot pay a high salary. And the way you can get the top talent, the way we can bring in the people that we need out of state or get them to leave a company that is a more mature industry here, like an Intel, is to give them the stock option. Sometimes you give them incentive stock options, sometimes you give them non-qualified. It really depends on how you want to take the impact on the company, where you want your company to go. And sometimes it depends on who they are. Are they consultants? They'll have to take non-qualified. But really, the distinction is driven more between the two. I'd like to lump them together. But the thought was that when you try and target the management pool, when you, the people who will mentor the others, when you try and recognize fill in a greater volume of angel investors, you've got to pick up what is an increasing number of people who will come within that model. And the point is, they only get this benefit if they invest in the Oregon companies. We've got a good definition of what is Oregon, so the impact is going to be there, and it's going to be immediate. And again, remember, most of this money goes into wages, so you get a lot of it back in taxes on those wages. But hopefully, it creates a company that will be the next Intel, or spin off 5 or 10 more companies that will just geometrically expand the growth impact.
So, sure. And while having received the answer, it obviously is quite an important part of this bill, and is something that would be quite easy to take with you as you move to Vancouver and to not have to pay those taxes. And so it would probably be one of the easiest things to be able to transport to another area, which then Oregon would never have the ability to have access to those capital gains taxes anyway. Because if you move to your golf course in Arizona, you could take those stock options and the stocks with you. As we've seen, if that becomes your domicile, you do not owe taxes to the state of Oregon. So it's reasonable to include in the bill, and I'm sure I've thoroughly confused you, so I shall finish.
For further discussion, further questions for Mr. Douglas? Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1211? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1211. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1211.
Mr. Wilde. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I shall move SB 1211 for a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde moves Senate Bill 1211 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
No.
If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hartman.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Byrd.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilde.
Aye.
Chair Miller.
Both aye. Senate Bill 1211 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1211. Senator Byrd, I'm sure you're so excited about this.
Yeah. Senator Wilde has such a wonderful description of this. I would be happy to hear it.
Who on the floor would understand it?
We'll move on now.
Thank you, Senator Wilde.
I'd understand.
All right. We thank you, and now we'll move into a public hearing. House Bill 2133. Mr. Douglas, this is your day. This one only cost 10 minutes.
Ooh, cheap.
Really, I thought it would come out.
What we're trying to do, this is trying to modify in a very modest way the research and development tax credit at the state level. And our goal here is, in the most immediate sense, to broaden the application of the R&D credit to make sure that it is used by a much broader spectrum of companies. And we do that in two ways. We there is a carry forward on this. So when you make qualifying research and development expenditures, there is currently a 5% credit above a base. As you increase your expenditures, you get to take the credit on that increased expenditure. And this bill, and under the current law, there are certain designated industries that one can invest in and get this credit. This law removes the qualification of which industries. It's really hard to know where innovation will come from and where the impact will be. And if you're trying to create innovation, and that does come through research and development, and interestingly, studies have shown that it really comes when you take two disciplines and you try and work in between them, when you combine them, when you have two people, someone in math and someone in physics working together, that as they bring their disciplines together, that's when you get true innovation. And so by broadening the applicability of the R&D credit, you're going to have a better chance of creating that milieu in which innovation can occur, as well as the direct impact on research and spinning off new technologies. The other thing that this bill will do is currently there is a 5-year carry forward of this credit. Companies that are particularly biotechnology companies have tremendous research and development expenditures, and they generate losses, tax losses in the early stages when they come up with a product. And I don't have hard evidence on this, but I have talked to the accounting firms. They haven't developed statistical data on this, but they assure me, as do people in the industry, that our credits are not being used by these startup companies. Within the 5-year period, they have tax losses and they can never use them. So it's not creating the kind of incentive that it's designed to do. So what we've done simply is to say that these can be carried forward until they become profitable and then can use them. So it does reward the investment and the behavior that we're trying to do and create with the credit. The third thing that we have done is we have increased the credit from 5 to 10%, which is where it is at the federal level. These are rather modest amendments to the bill, and it's with a desire immediately to broaden that. Our task force is already beginning to do a more extensive review. We've actually had some interest from the Oregon delegation about pursuing some of these amendments at the federal level as well. So I think I would hope in 2 years to be coming back with an even more targeted and meaningful amendment of the R&D credit, that this will have an immediate impact. And all three of these are important modifications.
We thank you. Representative Jensen has arrived. And you'd like to comment on House Bill 2133. I would be delighted to have your testimony now before we really get after Mr. Douglas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here again to speak to you on this bill, and I really I had nothing additional to say beyond what we said the other day. I just thought I would stop in to see if there were any questions that you had as you started to go through this, and if there were, that I might be able to at least try to answer those questions.
Are there questions?
You've done a masterful job.
That's what happens when you're very independent.
Oh, here we go.
We're
a two-person caucus.
Yeah, we were.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Mr. Douglas, you want to come back up? And
Mr. Chair, while he's coming.
Sure.
Under a while. I do like to carry forward because it's, when you think, especially in the area of biotech, the years of research it takes to get to a final product, and then, of course, you have to go through the test phases. It's just, I mean, you absolutely have to be able to have, I mean, fertility firms, even 5 years is kind of limited because the time it takes to be able to use all of those losses you've accumulated. And it would be nice if we could just make sure they had the ability to use them at some time because they sure do generate something. And I followed that industry a long time, and it's amazing how patient you have to be hoping they finally get a product.
Thank you, Senator Weil. Now, Mr. Douglas, the amendments that we'd have the dash ones after the 5th of this month contain the 10% figure that in the House did not have that figure, and it did.
My understanding, this is an amendment to legislation that has passed the House. It has not passed the House.
So they, it was still 5% when it was passed by the House. And the same would be true with the carry forward to the unlimited as opposed to a...
Mr. Chairman, of the committee, the dash one amendment, does anyone have the dash one amendment?
I do.
I have that.
I do. Well...
They didn't come to our...
Oh, that chair is advanced.
So you're the only one that has the
That's the first group.
I have
the
dash one.
Got some? All right, I apologize for that.
Dash one? You had dash one?
Yeah. Yeah. Figures actually they had chart with all the right colors.
Anyway, the dash one amendments were not of concern in the original bill. This is an additional item of interest. The dash two amendments, which Representative Jensen was speaking to, do pertain to the bill, original content of the bill.
And Mr. Waters, we have the revenue impact statement. Do you all have that? It is dated 4/28. We received that today, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that was generated off of the dash one.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It pertains to the dash one. The original bill has no revenue.
And that's just something, a note of interest here is that, of course, this bill passed unanimously, I believe, in the House, not that it's influential, but it was there was one person excused, four excused for business, and 55 ayes. And I'm just, I guess I'd have the same question as when you all came up with the impact or heard of the impact. Have a reaction to the $10 million revenue impact and think that you'll enjoy the same success as we hope you will on 1211. Had you heard of this? Or?
Well, I will say that I had not been had not received a copy of the impact, so the number is new to me. But I'm not sure I understand your question, Senator.
Well,
you're
looking kind of convoluted.
Well, the question is, did sometimes we get an adverse reaction anytime there is some reduction in our general fund forecast by anything we do here, the chief executive tends not to like that. So I'm just trying to find out what the future of this bill is should be passed in this amended form.
Are you getting gun shy?
No, not at all.
I do not have a read with the governor on this one. This was a bill that we amended for this. I don't really know if he has a position on this that I can report to. I will tell you that certainly the carry forward and the deletion of pesticide industries are critical. If you are severely concerned about the revenue impact, keeping the rates high still is a marked improvement on the bill. I mean, if you are concerned about that, that would be a that you may wish to consider. It still gets, it still broadens the impact of the R&D. You will see me back in 2 years as well trying to do that.
Well, I'm not suggesting you need to change the amendment. Not for me. Senator Byer?
Question, Seth. Ed, the $10 million, is that just simply doubling the current experience?
Attorney Byer, that's roughly correct. The tax expenditure report shows the revenue value of this in the 99-01 biennium is $17.8 million. So I've done is split that into 2 years, and then since the credit is being essentially doubled from 5% of qualified expenses to 10%, in addition to an expanded list of industries being eligible to take the credit, and to be able to carry it forward for a longer period of time, I assume that the revenue impact would be double. Those numbers are going to double.
Just a bit of history. Where this came from is in the interim between the 93 and 95 sessions, and I think this was bipartisan support. The Revenue Committee in the House started this with the intent of establishing Oregon as the best place from a state taxation standpoint and research and development to do R&D in the country. I think we were for about one legislative session when the other states caught up and passed us by, as well as the feds made some changes. So there's a tradition from past sessions of trying to keep us in place on this. And again, these are the kinds of investments I believe that are more likely to create the kinds of high-wage jobs that our economic policy has been going after and make sense.
Thank you. For the discussion, Representative.
They're having a rough go of it, aren't they?
Yeah.
I misspoke earlier, so I'm pleased to see in the amendments that 5 years is out, and by the wording that you simply can't keep sending it forward until you finally use it up, which I like that idea. That way you don't have to fool around with the books in order to use it up in your 5-year period. You can actually be very honest about it and just apply it as necessary.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Douglas? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wished to testify on House Bill 2133? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2133. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2133. Senator Wilde.
Mr. Chairman, I move to dash one amendment to HB 2133.
Senator Wilde moves to dash one amendment to House Bill 2133. Their discussion of the amendments. Their objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendments are agreed to. Amend the bill is before us.
Mr. Chair.
We need the buyer, we have the dash two. And Senator Beyer moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2133. Is there discussion? Objection? On the amendment that was agreed to. We now have the further amended House Bill 2133 before us, and Senator Wilde.
I will move HB 2133 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde moves House Bill 2133 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. For discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Stein.
Aye.
Senator
Byrne. Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. House Bill 2133 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session. House Bill 2133. Senator Beyer, this is your area.
Yeah. All right.
Is there anything further to come before the committee? No. If not, we are adjourned.